And I'll remind our listeners that we will be taking a break from the air here on Current State after this Friday as we prepare to relaunch our program for 2017. When we return in January, I hope you will move with me to our new day and time beginning in January, Current State, Saturday mornings at 11 with an encore Sunday afternoons at 4 here on 90.5 FM. The show, the program's not going to change much. Still issues, news, arts, attitudes, all kinds of Lansing and Michigan regional news, fresh features all week long in the Current State podcast and at WKAR.org. So after Friday, we move to Saturdays and Sundays here on WKAR. And I will be looking forward to connecting with you as the incoming host of All Things Considered every weekday afternoon on 90.5. It's Current State here on WKAR. President-elect Donald Trump and America's intelligence community are at odds over allegations that Russia may have hacked into the Democratic National Committee's cyber network to influence last month's election. The rhetoric underscores the importance of strong cybersecurity. A new program underway in a southeast Michigan public school district is blazing a trail for future IT specialists. The Pinckney Community School District has recently cut the ribbon on its new Cyber Training Institute, the first of its kind in the United States. Joining me to talk about this enterprise is the district's Director of Cybersecurity, Dr. Jim Darga. Hi, Jim.
Good morning. How are you?
We are well, and we're glad you're here. Also with me in Studio S, Brigadier General Michael Stone, the Assistant Adjutant General for Installations, who oversees cybersecurity for the Michigan Army National Guard. General Stone, welcome.
Good morning.
How did this concept of a school to teach cybersecurity get started here, General Stone?
It really goes back to 2011. Governor Rick Snyder, when he came into office, put together a cyber executive team. We developed a state strategy working with Michigan State Police, the Michigan National Guard, Department of Technology, Management Budget. But Dr. Don Welch participated, and he was the president of Merit. Merit is your nonprofit that has all your fiber that connects your universities, community colleges. By later this coming year, we'll have 100% of our high schools connected to this large fiber optic network. And Dr. Welch brought to the group this concept of cyber ranges, unclassified cyber ranges for training workforce. So in our first state cyber initiative strategy, we contemplated and tried to figure out how we're going to grow the workforce, how we're going to create this ecosystem in Michigan with cyber ranges unclassified to train future workforce for the demands of protecting our critical infrastructure in our country. We talked about and contemplated getting down to K-12 for cyber ranges. But here it is, finally a reality. It is something that we have done with universities. It's something we've done with the military, but it is the first time that we've pushed it down to the high school level.
Jim Darga, can you tell us about the curriculum, please?
Well, we're very fortunate because we started a Cisco Academy about 15 years ago, and part of the Cisco curriculum is cybersecurity. So it has been embedded in our curriculum. That's been available to all the students in Livingston County. But now we could take it to the next level where our students can actually train on the cyber range. And then we can also offer courses. We have over 20 courses that we can offer to IT professionals that are in line with the Department of Defense guidelines and requirements.
You've both referred to the Michigan Cyber Range. Let's go a little bit deeper there and help our listeners understand what that is. General Stone, that's a larger system, and the Cyber Training Institute is part of it. What is the Cyber Range?
Absolutely. So if you think Cyber Range, the easiest way to think of it is a weapons qualification range or a range, a place you can go in a closed network, closed fiber, not on the open internet, where you can do cyber training and you can launch malware. Merit talks about teach, test, train. It's this closed environment. They've created within the Michigan Cyber Range a virtual city called Alphaville. In Alphaville, you've got a library with personal identifiable information. You've got a town hall. You've got a water and sewer system. And those are places where students can go in and play games to get scoring that's all tied to NIST and NSA standards, National Institute of Science and Technology standards, and NSA standards for training. But it's also a place where you can go, what we'd say in the Army, weapons-free and play, and there's no spillage, there's no issues with malware, that type of thing. It's in a closed environment.
Jim Dargo, can you talk to us about what kinds of online threats there are out there that you can teach someone to prevent or at least to help defend a computer network against?
Well, there's a wide range of online threats that can attack a network. I mean, for example, there's a social network threats where, you know, people, for example, will receive email messages that are designed to get people to click on a particular link, and that link will cause a virus to enter the system. Once a virus is in the system, then, you know, hackers can penetrate into a network and obtain all kinds of intellectual property, personal information, and or perhaps if it's a manufacturing situation, they can shut down a manufacturing plant, or if it's a power grid, it's possibly taking down a power grid.
We are talking about the Michigan Cyber Range, also about a new initiative underway at the Pinckney Community Schools called the Cyber Training Institute. My guests are Dr. Jim Dargo, who you just heard from. He's the Director of Secondary Curriculum and Cybersecurity with the Pinckney Community Schools. Also joining us, Brigadier General Mike Stone, the Assistant Adjutant for Installations with the Michigan Army National Guard. Talk to us, Mike Stone, about how the National Guard and other groups use this as a training tool.
Absolutely. So everything that's been created by Merritt and Dr. Joe Adams, who runs it, who's a retired Army colonel, revolves around these NIST and NSA standards and cybersecurity certificates that are federally recognized. It's not only for the Department of Defense to have these certificates to defend Department of Defense networks, but our critical infrastructure in our federal government as well. So the Michigan National Guard has been working collaboratively with Merit. Other partners, Michigan Economic Development Corporation, has been an enabler for these programs. We've worked with Workforce Intelligence Network, universities. But we do, at the Governor's North American Cyber Summit every fall, we're playing in Alphaville with the California Air National Guard. And when we opened one of our hubs at the 110th Air Wing in Battle Creek, we had West Point cadets actually attacking the critical infrastructure we were defending. And 2 years ago, we were partnered with the country of Latvia. General Vadnay, my boss, the adjutant general, was in Latvia with the Latvians who were attacking Alphaville, and we were defending from Cobalt Hall in Detroit.
How about that? Let's talk a little bit more about Alphaville here for a minute. This simulates a virtual city, and one feature of Alphaville is a version of the old game Capture the Flag. I'm not sure who is more qualified to answer that question, but I'll let whoever wants it take it.
I can start, and Doctor, you can pick it up. But I think a short version is you can have red teams, blue teams going in, and they're looking for code. They have to do certain things to standard to find the code and plug the code in to get scores and capture the flag. So you've got to go through the city, and at the same time, the other team can be trying to do bad things to you and steal things away from you. So, Doctor, I don't know if that's an oversimplification or if you want to expand on that.
That's pretty accurate. And the wonderful thing about it is it's real-world experience for those people participating in the activity, that you can actually seek out at true vulnerabilities, whether it's a power grid, a library, a school, and it simulates real-world conditions. So it really hones the skills, the cybersecurity skills of those participating.
Dr. Dargy, you just cut the ribbon on the CTI last week, but Pinckney's been laying the groundwork for this project for some time, as we've learned. What skills have your students already been learning that apply to cybersecurity?
We have some absolutely amazing students here at Pinckney Community High School, especially in the networking program. Our students, they've been very instrumental in actually setting up the center itself. We've allowed them to become involved in every aspect of the development and implementation of the operation. So our students have learned how to actually set up the lab. Now they're learning how to actually function in the virtual space of the sandbox. And we've actually had students participate with our teachers in the sandbox training that was provided by Merit. So they've been learning all the way along in the process.
I want to ask you, I mean, are young people, are high school age people earning certifications here, important certifications?
Absolutely. So for the Michigan National Guard, we've got a cyber protection team in the Army that we share with Ohio and Indiana. We have a cyber operations squadron for their readiness. Not only do they have to go off to an Army or Air Force school, but they have to have these same certificates that are being taught here at, in Pinckney, or will be taught in Pinckney going forward. So it's very valuable. We've had in Lieutenant General Cardone, the Army Cyber Command commander last year to Michigan, and he is full speed ahead. We had the Secretary of Defense Office, Office of Economic Adjustment, as part of the grant that supported this program. Them and a representative from NSA were all at the Pinckney High School ribbon cutting because it's so important to grow these certificates. You can't even get on a Department of Defense network without the certificates they're teaching there.
I want to ask you both whether you anticipate this kind of curriculum and this kind of institution spreading to other school districts. Dr. Dargo, what do you think?
Well, I certainly hope that it would, because it's just a dramatic need for cybersecurity professionals. It is a challenge because you do have to have the facility and you got to have qualified staff members to do this. And we're poised to do that right now. But I certainly hope it does create interest and spread through other high schools, not just in Michigan, throughout the country.
Have education officials responded to this? Have they had any comment about this kind of curriculum in the public schools?
Well, first of all, there already is a couple of cyber, high school cyber programs like Cyber Patriot, and Pinckney High School was well-known for that and how well it's done in that national competition. We want to create this ecosystem in Michigan, like our high school robotics, where we've got high school teams. The teams are enablers to having actually things like the Pinckney Cyber Range, the Michigan Cyber Range at places like Pinckney. So, yes, the vision is to have these regionally around the state and where not just high school students can plug in, but adult ed, retraining veterans, partners with universities, community colleges. We want an ecosystem where anybody can log in, take these certificates and earn them locally in anywhere in Michigan.
And it's conceivable that someone graduating from this program could end up working for the Michigan National Guard in this kind of capacity?
We have over 700 part-time IT and cyber jobs in the Michigan Guard. That's something that a lot of people think about, you know, your uncle's National Guard were a little bit different and we're changing pretty rapidly. There's a dramatic growth in the Department of Defense, and we're proud to grow that cyber workforce because in our vision, we don't want to go out and recruit everybody to be full-time in the military. We'd love them to go on active duty for a couple of years, gain some skills, get these certificates, come back. But we'd love them to work in Ann Arbor, Detroit, Lansing, Grand Rapids, make $100,000 a year in their civilian job and work part-time in the Army or Air National Guard and put on a uniform and have a top-secret clearance and go out and do great things for our nation.
Dr. Jim Darga, how do you instill a sense of ethics into your students? Aren't they learning the same skills that hackers learn?
You know, that is indeed an excellent question, because in order to defend against hackers, you need to know the same strategies that they're going to employ against you. So included with our curriculum is ethical hacking units, in which the students actually learn how to be ethical hackers, where they look for vulnerabilities, but they also learn how to develop reports and how to process those reports through the chain of command so the vulnerabilities are addressed within a network of the organization.
The Training Institute's really meant to be a community asset, not just something for the Pinckney School District, I understand. Who else is involved, Jim Darga?
Well, you know, it's been a great partnership with all those partners that General Stone has already mentioned, but we're also working with post-secondary partners, which include Washtenaw Community College, Eastern Michigan University, University of Michigan, as well as Clery University. And Clery University is actually going to be going to their Board of Trustees in January to propose a new bachelor's degree program through which 8 of the classes will all be offered within our hub setting here. So they'll be using the cyber range as part of their learning experience. And we've also had great opportunities to develop partnerships with local businesses, whether it's Cisco, with Brightline out of Brighton, other organizations that have supported us and provided resources that we needed to make this program that we want at the level of excellence we want it to be.
We've been talking about a unique cybersecurity training curriculum, the first of its kind in the United States. The Pinckney Community Schools in Livingston County has just launched the PCS, Pinckney Cyber Training Institute and Sentinel Center. It's a hands-on program for high school students, also IT professionals. allowing them to practice their abilities on the Michigan Cyber Range. Brigadier General Michael Stones, an Assistant Adjutant General for Installations with the Michigan Army National Guard. And we thank Dr. Jim Darga, Director of Secondary Curriculum and Cybersecurity for the Pinckney Community Schools. Thanks to both of you, and best of luck with the project.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Coming up on Current State, the Flint water crisis became a top story in 2016, but it wasn't the only development involving Michigan water or the Great Lakes. We'll review and update those stories and take a look ahead to 2017 with Great Lakes journalist commentator Gary Wilson. That's coming up on Current State. Current State on 90.5 WKAR. Thank you for joining us. A legend of bluegrass music will appear in Lansing tonight. Joe Newberry plays banjo and guitar, and he's worked with some of the top names in the business. Scott Pohl talked with Joe Newberry ahead of tonight's show at Elderly Instruments. WKAR listeners have probably heard him on a Prairie Home Companion, correct?
That's right, Mark. Joe Newberry comes from a very musical family with all sorts of American traditional music and sacred songs around him all the time. He obviously got a very early start.
I tell people that I wrote my first song when I was five. It was a blatant ripoff of the Kingston Trio's Tom Dooley, and mine was called "Hang Down Your Head, Bugs Bunny."
Do you remember it?
I only really remember the last verse. But what happened is Bugs stole carrots and they hung him.
Oh my
gosh.
So
the last verse is, Bugs Bunny's still a carrot lover. He still loves them night and day. The only difference about Bugs is he's eating carrots at Heaven's Gate.
Oh, my gosh.
And for five, that's not bad.
That's not bad.
But I do. I remember I was the kid that would crawl downstairs after, all of my cousins and my sister were asleep at my Uncle John's, and all the adults would be gathered in the living room, doing adult, having a party, and I'd appear at the top of the stairs and come down and announce that I was going to sing. And so I would do that, and then they would, I guess, smile and shoo me back to bed.
A performer since kindergarten. You mentioned sacred music. That's remained a big part of your repertoire, hasn't it?
It has. It has. My grandfather, Newberry, was a Baptist preacher, and actually grandmother would fold and put four handkerchiefs in his, a handkerchief for each pocket in his trousers and a couple in his coat pocket, because he would get so worked up and he'd cry during a sermon. And so she always packed a lot of handkerchiefs for him. So sacred music has always been a part of my life, but also my family. And when I started writing, I've had pretty good success with writing songs about relatives who've gone on, and the Gibson brothers have recorded a number of them. Val Mindell and Emily Miller have recorded those songs of mine. It got to the point where I started thinking, well, damn, Newberry, can't you write a fun song? So I've done some of those as well. But the sacred is never far from me, it's like I say sometimes on stage, you're never too far from Sunday morning. Even if it's just Saturday night, you're never too far from Sunday morning.
Ah. Now, Joe Newberry, you have appeared on a Prairie Home Companion. We need to talk about the show a little bit. First of all, going back to the Garrison Keillor days, of course.
Sure.
How many times did you appear on the show? Who did you play with? What can you tell me about a Prairie Home Companion?
Well, I can tell you a little bit about how it came to be. And over the years, I've probably on 20 times, something like that, maybe a few less. But in 2007, I got a call from the man who had recorded my solo CD, and this call came out of the blue. He said, "Hey, what are you doing October 20th?" Or, I said, "Well, I'm working a show that day." And he said, "Oh, that's too bad, because the folks at Prairie Home called and wanted you to come play on a show in Charlotte." And I thought, well, I guess I'll be the only person that's ever turned them down. But I was already booked, And so I gave my regrets, and I thought, well, you know, it was nice to be asked. Well, then in 2009, a friend of my band's ran a bookstore and was having a book signing that Garrison was doing, and it was they expanded it, and they were doing it at one of the convention centers. You know, he had probably 1,000 people there to hear his reading. And our friend said, who ran the bookstore, said, "Hey, would you just come and play for folks as they wait in line? You know, not a performance really, but just to give folks a little something to do while they waited in line." And we said, "Well, sure, that'd be fun." And Garrison was signing books after his talk, and we, my band Big Medicine, we sang a Watson Family song called "The Lone Pilgrim." And Garrison stopped signing and walked over and sang it with us. And that impressed me to no end because, you know, it's not that's not one that you find on the jukeboxes. Mm. And he's got a real deep appreciation and knowledge of American traditional music. And so afterward, we went up and we said, "Well, that was fun, and then thank you very much for singing with us." And he said, "I'd like you to be on the show." And I said, "Well, that'd be great sometime." He said, "No, we're coming to Durham. I'd like you to be on the show." So that was in 2009. We had a great time on the show. In 2012, Doc Watson had just passed away. The Prairie Home came back to Cary, North Carolina, which is very near our home, and they asked us to be on again. And we did a tribute to Doc, and I played some banjo, and I sang with Garrison for the first time, just him and me, because he knew that I was old friends with Tommy Thompson, the banjo player for the Ray Clay Ramblers, and Garrison and Tommy were huge fans of each other and friends. Anyway, about 4 months later, I get a call out of the blue, and it came right to me, and it was Deb Beck from Prairie Home Productions, and she said, "We're doing a banjo show, and Garrison would like to know if you would come and play banjo with Bill Evans and Noam Pikelny and be our guest on the show." And once that happened, we had a great time.
Arkansas Traveler, you all know this tune. Talking to you folks.
I did the 40th anniversary broadcast and the one the following year, and I've played on the show as a solo artist. I also played on with my duo partner Mike Compton, and appeared with Jim Watson, Bill Hicks, and Mike Craver, the guys who started the Ray Clay Ramblers. And that was some of the most fun ever to see these guys get together with Garrison, because the Ramblers were on the broadcast a lot in the early days.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was really neat to watch all of them reconnect and just hang out. And I had the best seat in the house. You know, I just, they were great.
Are you listening to the updated show hosted by Chris Thiele?
I am. Because of my playing schedule, I'm not around as much on Saturday nights these days, but I'm listening to the rebroadcast. And occasionally, when I'm home on a Saturday, I'll tune in. I think he's doing a great job. And the other thing is that Garrison and Chris share this genius for being themselves. And I think Garrison chose very wisely. Garrison, to me, has an unerring view of what the show needs to be. And I think he knew that it needed to be a different kind of host. And Chris is going to make it his own. He already has. And my gosh, the level of talent that he's bringing onto the show, and his ability to turn on a dime and play literally anything is astounding. And I'm really proud of the work he's done, and I'm looking forward to the work he's going to do.
We're talking with singer, songwriter, guitarist, banjo player Joe Newberry. On Tuesday night, he'll perform at Elderly Instruments in Lansing at 7:30. I want to talk about your work with the Gibson Brothers, including the song "They Called It Music." It's an award-winning song. Let's listen to a little bit first, and then we'll talk about it.
They called it music in the church house in the fields. It was honest, it was simple, and it helped the hard times heal. It was music. They sang it deep down in the mines, in dark and lonesome prison cells, and behind battle lines. They called it music.
They Called It Music came about because I was visiting with an older player around Galax, Virginia, and I said, you know, I'm always interested in this cross between genres. And so I asked him, I said, well, back when you were young, did you call it old time? Did you call it bluegrass? Did you call it country? And he looked at me kind of funny, and he said, well, son, we called it music. And I told Eric Gibson that, and Eric, he ran with it, and he wrote this song and was very gracious to give me a co-write. But it really is a great glimpse into the power that music has in people's lives, and the way that it can comfort the afflicted, and how it can make people happy. And if you're sad, it'll make you glad.
Tell us about your own latest recording projects.
I've done a project in the last year with John Shane. He's a great singer and songwriter and blues player from Durham. We have recorded a lot of original songs. That's called Crow the Dawn. Earlier in December, I went into the studio with my friend and collaborator April Virch, the great fiddler and singer and step dancer who's from the Ottawa Valley in Canada. And we recorded a project, should be out sometime in February. And we're having a blast playing together. I also have a great amount of fun with my duo partner Mike Compton, the great Mike Compton, mandolin icon, and just all around great player and guy. Mike, of course, plays with a Nashville bluegrass band. He also, when Elvis Costello goes out acoustically, Mike will play the mandolin in the Sugar Canes. Mike does a great solo show as well. So if you look around, I'm just the luckiest guy you've ever run into. That's basically how I approach life. Is I'm really lucky to play with super talented people.
You're playing solo at Elderly Instruments, right?
I am. I'm going to stop through. I work for Stan Werben sometimes and Ken Perlman at the Midwest Banjo Camp, and so I just thought, well, I'm going to be driving near there. Maybe I'll stop in, and they allowed me to put a solo show together. So it'll be mostly Christmas and holiday stuff. I might do a couple of other things.
Hallelujah sings the choir. Hallelujah, come what may. Hallelujah, every hour of Christmas Day. Hallelujah, every hour of Christmas Day.
I like playing solo. It's nice to sort of walk the wire by yourself, and and then it's also going to be live streamed on Concert Window. So if folks aren't nearby but they still want to see the old guy do his thing, they can tune in that way too.
Well, listen, I hope you have a lot of fun at Elderly Instruments. You're going to attract, I'm sure, a lot of people who really love the music and know the music are going to be there to see you at Elderly Instruments, 7:30 on Tuesday night. Joe Newberry, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me, and happy holidays.
And to you, thanks a lot. And for Current State, this is Scott Pohl.
Coming up on Current State, he just finished watching movies for 24 hours in one movie theater. We'll get a rundown of the Butt-Numathon Film Festival from WKAR's Jamie Paisley, including how he and his fellow marathoners will be part of next year's Star Wars Episode 8. That's coming up on Current State. We encourage everyone to drive with care today as snow continues in the forecast. Sometimes even small amounts of it can be really treacherous, so do exercise caution. I'm Mark Bayshore. This is Current State on WKAR. Every Tuesday, this program discusses the environment. Since this is the last Tuesday for current state ahead of our move to weekends here on WKAR, we thought we'd take a look back at 2016's biggest Great Lakes environmental stories. Michigan was in the forefront of a number of those. The Flint water crisis hit a tipping point. Great Lakes governors voted in a landmark decision to divert Lake Michigan water to Waukesha, Wisconsin, and there will be a changing of the guard involving the Great Lakes. For all of that, we welcome back our Great Lakes reporter, commentator Gary Wilson. Hi, Gary.
Hey, Mark. Good morning, sir.
Let's start with Flint. Last January was a critical month in the Flint water crisis. Briefly remind us what was happening here not quite a year ago.
Well, sure, Mark. If you remember, and it's important to remember, we were coming off of a volatile December. That's when Governor Snyder's task force on Flint issued an interim report that placed the blame for Flint clearly at the doorstep of the Department of Environmental Quality. The task force felt that the DEQ's failure was so egregious that the findings couldn't wait for a final report, which would be months away. And then shortly after, DEQ Director Dan Wyatt resigned under pressure, as did Brad Werfel, the communications director. It was Werfel who had publicly chastised some of those who had questioned Michigan's handling of Flint. Governor Snyder apologized for Flint and accepted responsibility, but not personal responsibility for the crisis. And then in January of 2016, the U.S. EPA, after a long delay, finally used its emergency authority to intervene in Flint, and the regional administrator who was responsible, Susan Hedman, resigned. That was after it was revealed in the Detroit News that she knew months earlier about Flint's lead problems, but said nothing publicly. So it was a crazy time. It was a volatile time. It was a time when you read the paper, listened to the radio, and there seemed to be a new revelation every day.
And then Governor Rick Snyder testified before Congress about Flint, and he testified along with EPA Administrator Gina McCarthy in March. How did that play out?
That was a spectacle, Mark. I still go back occasionally and look at the tapes of that. Governor Snyder was very disciplined. He apologized again to the members of Congress for Michigan's failure in Flint, and again accepted responsibility for it. But EPA Administrator McCarthy was having none of it. She was on attack, and she blamed Michigan and accepted no responsibility for the water failure and for the EPA's failure, and in fact still hasn't accepted any responsibility yet, even though the EPA Inspector General not too long ago issued a public rebuke of the EPA for its lack of actions. But these hearings were mostly political theater, with Democrats vilifying Snyder and Republicans going after McCarthy. Not Congress at its best, but it was worth watching.
Flint has been in the news all year, but recently, last week, federal funding for Flint was approved. Talk to us about the status of water quality now.
Well, it's definitely improved, Mark, although you can read conflicting reports about how safe it is. So there's no all clear yet on tap water, but it's on the cusp of meeting acceptable standards. And as you mentioned, just last week, Congress finally got around, after months of wrangling, to authorizing $100 million for Flint, which has been long overdue. And that was primarily due to the diligence of Representative Dan Kildee from Flint, Michigan's two senators, Stabenow and Peters. But all this was held up in Washington, because the sentiment was there that Flint's problems were Flint's problems and Michigan's problems and not a national problem.
We're talking with Gary Wilson, Great Lakes environmental reporter and commentator, taking a look back at some of the biggest environmental stories involving the Great Lakes in 2016. Now, in June, Great Lakes governors, with the support of two Canadian premiers, voted unanimously to approve Waukesha, Wisconsin's decade-long quest for Great Lakes water. What was the issue for Waukesha, and why was it important?
Well, Waukesha, Mark, had long been under a mandate to find a new source of water because its wells are contaminated with radium. And after doing its own diligence, it settled on Lake Michigan as the only viable source. Now, the problem for Waukesha is that it's just outside the Great Lakes Basin and therefore not automatically entitled to Great Lakes water, so it had to secure the approval of all eight Great Lakes governors. And that's important because the request was the first under the Great Lakes Compact, which is designed to keep water in the basin. And it was generally thought to be precedent-setting because there are other communities out there with similar needs.
What was Michigan's role in the Waukesha decision?
Well, it had a big role, and if Michigan's role in Flint was less than exemplary, its role in Waukesha was that of exemplary leadership. Michigan was seen by the other states as the de facto leader of the process, and it did well for itself. Grant Trigger, working for John Allen in the Office of the Great Lakes, guided the other states through the technical and the procedural process, and the other states looked to Michigan for expertise. And the result was that the decision, whether people like it or not, and there are people on both sides of that fence, but the decision has a firm basis on which to stand, and that's important.
The decision aside, a legal challenge was expected, and a group of Great Lakes regional forces are rattling all kinds of legal cages here. What's happening on that front?
Well, it's primarily the mayors. The Great Lakes and St. Lawrence Cities Initiative is the group, and it's U.S. and Canadian mayors, and they've petitioned the governors, requesting a formal hearing to once again make their case that the governors got it wrong. And it's generally thought that this is going to be a requisite precursor to a legal challenge. So when we think we're done with Waukesha, we might not be.
With the Trump administration set to take office, key Great Lakes executives appointed by the Obama administration will likely move on. Michigan's Lana Pollack and Dave Dempsey have held key positions at the U.S. and Canadian International Joint Commission, which advises both countries on transborder water issues. Also, Cameron Davis from Chicago has been President Obama's go-to person for the Great Lakes. What have been their respective roles and accomplishments here over the last 8 years?
Yeah, this is going to be big potentially for the Great Lakes region, as these three folks have been in the front lines for a long time. Lana Pollack has been the U.S. chair of the International Joint Commission, and she's generally credited with refocusing that group away from its historic bureaucratic leanings and making a concerted effort to engage citizens again. It had kind of fallen away from that for a long time. She also put a spotlight on Lake Erie's problems and supported her positions with good science. And she also has her signature on a plan to restore tens of thousands of acres of wetland on Lake Ontario. So that's no small feat. Now, Dave Dempsey from Michigan also, Dave's one of the best policy minds in the region, I would add, and he did extensive work behind the scenes on the IJC's Lake Erie Algae Plan. And I'd add that Dave's an MSU guy to boot, so both of those folks will be missed. Now, Cam Davis, he oversaw the $2 billion Great Lakes Restoration Initiative for the Obama administration. He's generally recognized for coining the phrase that under the Obama administration, the Great Lakes would receive a new standard of care, and that's generally happened. So Davis has been in the trenches for a long time. So whether we agree with their policies or not, these folks have been a policy force, and a lot of institutional memory will be leaving when they do.
Is it likely they'll be replaced?
Well, Mark, now we're entering into murky waters. As we all know, it's hard to predict what any Trump administration will do. We do know that the EPA especially is in the Trump's administration's sights. I see it hard to see a replacement coming for Cam Davis. That slot was created specifically for the restoration initiative. Could be wrong, but I don't see a replacement for Davis. Now, Lana Pollack is a different story. She has a direct interface that's codified in the law with Canadian counterparts. So again, anything is possible under the Trump administration, but I would see her being replaced.
And briefly, Gary, what's on your radar for 2017?
Always good to look ahead. Flint, the issue is going to be around for some time in some form, but what I would and that's good, we need to keep an eye on Flint, but I'd keep my eye on the Enbridge Straits of Mackinac pipeline and Nestle's request to the MDEQ for more water for bottled water. Pipelines and water taking strike a chord in Michigan these days, and activists I know will be energized on both of those issues in 2017. So, and I'm sure there'll be things that we can't see yet that'll keep us occupied.
We talked a few times about Lake Erie algae blooms as well in 2016, Gary. What kind of year was it? How are you processing what happened this year with regard to algae in Lake Erie?
Well, algae took time out. The weather forces were favorable for keeping the blooms in check, which is always a caution because next year could be another bad year. So algae is going to be a big issue in 2017 again. I just read the other day where the mayor of Toledo personally wrote to President-elect Trump and asked him to engage on Lake Erie's algae problems so he can put that on his stack of things to do. And in recently passed legislation, there's going to be an algae coordinator for Lake Erie. So algae is one of those things that's not going away in the near term.
We want to thank Gary Wilson, our Great Lakes reporter commentator, for this quick look back on 2016. Happy holidays, Gary. We'll talk to you next year.
Same to you, Mark, and the KAR staff. It was good to be with you this year.
This environmental segment of Current State is supported by Michigan State University's Knight Center for Environmental Journalism. For more news of the Great Lakes environment, check out greatlakesecho.org and wkar.org. Current State on 90.5 WKAR, anytime at WKAR.org. This past weekend, about 200 self-described film nerds assembled in Austin, Texas. They were there for an endurance test made up of 24 hours of nonstop movies. One of those 200 nerds, WKAR's own Jamie Paisley, joins me now to discuss his trip to this festival titled Butt-Numathon.
It is butt-numathon. And I admit, people have asked me as I've come into WKR, is my butt un-numb anymore? And I said, yes. In Texas weather, it's un-numb. But as soon as my flight landed, I realized, it's going to get numb again because of the cold, unfortunately.
What was the first movie you saw?
Well, it was Martin Scorsese's Silence, which is opening kind of Christmas weekend, kind of a Japanese drama. Well, Japanese-Portuguese, we'll say, since it's Portuguese priest set in the 17th century, which is to say 200 years before Commodore Perry and the forced opening up of Japan. And as they're dealing with kind of people, the Japanese people being fairly xenophobic at the time and how they responded to that. It's a production for Martin Scorsese. It took about 30 years to kind of finally get everything lined up to have this movie that's coming out finally. And it's gorgeous visuals, as you can expect, because it's Japan. It's pristine shorelines in that. Very gorgeous. But I personally had difficulty with some of the sound issues, like the ADR, the dubbing of the voices. There were some jarring moments that didn't seem to be very well polished in the audio sense from the Scorsese. It was surprising. But, I mean, it was still a film that can affirm both sides of faith, since it's dealing with Portuguese priests coming into the kind of a Buddhist mentality of things. And it's a film from Scorsese that seems to affirm both those that are questioning their faith and asking for kind of reaffirmation of it rather than going through.
Interesting.
It's riding that fine line throughout the 2 hours and 40 minutes of Scorsese's Silence. So that was how things kind of kick off, just kind of seeing the security guards, making sure nobody's videotaping anything for that. And the entire festival, it's kind of split down the middle, by the way, between half of them or so are kind of advanced preview releases, and then half of them are just kind of things from a century of movies, just things that the guy that curates it, Harry Knowles from Ain't It Cool News, he kind of picks whatever has been either underserved or just needs a bit of a reviewing. That's entirely what the 24 Hours is made
of. Sounds like a great mix of cinema here. What did you see that really stands out in your memory here?
For me, Silence wasn't my favorite new release. My favorite of the new releases that we got to see was something that's opening this Friday called Fences, and it's a movie adaptation of the August Wilson play, Call of the same name, and part of his Pittsburgh cycle of 10 plays that he had written about the African-American experience over a century in America in Pittsburgh. And it stars Denzel Washington, Viola Davis, and both of them are just chewing it up. Denzel, he's directing it as well.
Oh,
and I
really
think it's the first time that an August Wilson play has been produced for the films, I believe. I need to double check that at the moment. But it won this play, Fences, won the Pulitzer, won the Tony, and it will be coming up Oscar season as well. It's astonishingly good acting, but it is not the favorite film that I saw overall during those 24 hours. My favorite one was actually one of the vintage films from 1941 called Pimpernel Smith. And it was a British film, kind of 1941, and very anti-Nazi, set in 1939 as well, and talking about kind of our updated version of The Scarlet Pimpernel. With starring and directed by Lionel Smith, I believe.
Okay.
Not Smith. He was Ashley in Gone with the Wind. I can't remember. The name is escaping me at the moment, but really fantastic as he's directing this kind of mix between an archaeologist who fights Nazis who is not Indiana Jones, and it's mixed with kind of the Doctor Who kind of aloofness of that character. And my favorite bit at the very end, maybe my favorite five minutes of any film, final minutes where he's talking to his antagonist, the Nazi kind of this general who's been chasing him the entire movie, finally gets him alone in a room, and the shading on his face as he talks to the officer and to the camera itself about the dangers and horrors of fascism as well as a direct warning in this film in 1941. And it's a bit of a rediscover because at the time, across Europe, since this was British, a lot of countries banned the movie because they were afraid of the German reaction this. And so it was banned for quite some time until people finally caught up with what was going on, and it inspired this film directly. Pimpernel Smith inspired some other people to form rescue missions to bring out people out of Nazi Germany, the Jews that were being persecuted because of this film directly.
I'm talking with Jamie Paisley of WKAR. He's just returned from Austin, Texas for his annual sojourn to Butt Numathon, 24 hours of nonstop movies, the old, the new, and everything in between. How long has there been a Butt-Numathon, and how many have you attended?
This is the 18th, and I have been to four of them. This is my fourth one, but it's an application process. You're not guaranteed a seat until you have about 20 questions of a questionnaire. There's a photo entry as well, based on whatever the requirements are of the MC, Harry Knowles. And so you kind of line up your ducks in a row to get ready for it. And not, you know, everybody does. And I do mean everybody, because one of the attendees was a man named Ryan Johnson. And he is the writer-director of the Star Wars Episode 8 movie coming out in a year. And, you know, he's becoming a more and more famous guy. He directed Looper, Brick, The Brothers Bloom as well. And he's very much on the forefront of where writing and directing an auteur kind of theory is. So he got in front of the audience and said, all right, I want everybody to yell. And everybody yelled, the 200 of us yelled, and everybody boo, boo. Everybody kind of cheer, and we all did that. And he said, okay. And next year, says Ryan Johnson, next year you will all be heard in a Star Wars movie. So he recorded us, and we'll be using that audio in the Star Wars movie. That is a pretty cool moment.
No kidding.
Yeah, really great.
WKAR classical music host, fine arts reporter, and annual Butt-Numathon attendee, Jamie Paisley. Next time around, I want to ask you if you heard any music here that you're going to be featuring on Michigan Matinee. We will get into that at some point.
Well,
I promise.
Then I have to. I'll make it very short. But there was one film that we got a preview of that's opening in February called A Cure for Wellness, directed by Gore Verbinski, like the guy that did Pirates of the Caribbean and The Ring.
Okay.
And his movie, this kind of thriller, his music is done by a guy named Benjamin Wallfisch, which in a classical term, his parents were were Raphael and Elizabeth Wallfisch, the great cellist and violinist of classical renown. So he's going into film music as well.
Okay. There's a little sampling of things to come on Michigan Matinee, I'm sure. Jamie Paisley there from WKAR. That's our show for today. Tomorrow on Current State, when the world says goodbye to 2016 on New Year's Eve, Ingham County Sheriff Gene Rigglesworth will hang up his holster after a half century in law enforcement. From his days on the Michigan State Police to the county's top cop, we'll talk with Gene Rigglesworth about his career and his legacy, which will soon include watching his son succeed him as Sheriff Scott Rigglesworth. That and more tomorrow here on Current State. Our executive producer is Peter Wharf. Kevin Lavery directed the show today. Thanks also to Scott Pohl, Katie Cook, Jamie Paisley, Brooke Allen, and Drew Hill. I'm Mark Bayshore. Hope you can join us tomorrow. It's Current State on WKAR.